classic movie has that iconic scene that comes to stand for the entire film. In the original 1979 Alien, it's the one fans call the chest burster scene. This program is audio only, but I'm guessing your imagination filled in the gaps. John Hurt's character becomes suddenly and violently ill while eating dinner on the spaceship, writhing around on the table as his colleagues try to restrain him, when suddenly, the creepiest delivery since Rosemary's Baby. It may actually be more terrifying because that baby alien is a parasite which has entered its host's body undetected and literally sucked the life out of him. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I'm not going to say we've given parasites a bad name exactly, because while they may not grow up to be 9-foot screaming homicidal aliens, they sometimes can destroy their hosts. But many of them actually don't kill the organism they feed off of. Some are just neutral ride-alongs, others are part of a beneficial symbiosis. Whatever the setup, we miss out on a lot if we're so disturbed by parasitic life forms that we pretend they don't exist. Because they do exist in every climate on Earth and often play significant roles in the way ecosystems function. Scott L. Gardner is here to tell us more. He's curator of parasites in the H.W. Manter Laboratory of Parasitology at the University of Nebraska State Museum and professor of biological sciences at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. His book, written with Judy Diamond and Gabor Rocks, is called Parasites, The Inside Story. Scott, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So many of us would like to pretend either parasites don't exist or they can't come into our lives in any meaningful way. But it seems like if we can't get over our disgust, or rather if we can get over it, parasites are fascinating. And they can have different relationships, right, with the host organism that sustains them. Sometimes they are mutually beneficial.
Yes. Basically, there's a huge range. We can have things that are extremely dangerous, extremely pathogenic, which means it'll kill the host almost invariably, or make it really sick for a very long time. Or you could have some parasites that just don't do anything. Some of them even probably kind of live together with the host and maybe even provide some benefit. Some of them just make you itch, like pinworms might be kind of an itchy type of thing, but they don't really do anything else. There have been a few studies that show that pinworms might cause infection of the intestine a little bit, or inflammation, but really not that bad. It's appendicitis. An appendicitis might be an example of that, but it's very rare that it's actually been shown that that is the cause. So it's an interesting, they're really dynamically variable, very interesting.
Pinworms are really interesting because humans have basically carried them wherever they went on the planet, and they've helped scientists trace the movement of humans over time.
They have. One of the papers we wrote a few years ago was talking about the movement of Native North Americans into North America for the first time. So the people who came here either came across via the Pacific in canoes, or they came down the coast in canoes, or they came through the land bridge across Beringia into North America. And when they came, they had their pinworms.
And so how do we know this? What are we able to tell from contemporary pinworms?
Well, the pinworms in ancient peoples in North America and South America and other places have had, they're really easy to tell apart from other kinds of parasites because they have a real specific and signature form. You can tell the eggs when you see them. And if you look at a coprolite, it's a fossilized fecal piece of feces, then you can separate that out the eggs and you can look at them with a microscope and you know what they are. And some people are now trying to get DNA from ancient parasites. And that's another interesting aspect.
Pretty much every animal on the planet eats something else. What makes an organism a parasite as opposed to what's called a free living predator?
Well, that's a really good question. And that's one of the things that we concentrate on when I teach my parasitology classes, how do we really define parasitism? What defines it? Well, parasite is something that lives in or on another animal, and usually at the expense of the other animal. Sometimes, as we said at the beginning, sometimes the expense is huge, like it could really cause major problems. And other times, it could hardly use any energy at all. And so some of them are benign and some of them are pathogenic. And it just depends on the kind of parasite and the host-parasite relationship. It's really a dynamic field. And it's very interesting to study.
What do we know about the process of co-speciation, in which parasites evolve in a kind of, I guess, collaboration with the host organisms?
Well, there's a lot of work has been done and is currently being done on the ideas of co-speciation, co-evolution, and those types of things. The idea of co-evolution is that there has to be reciprocal back and forth interaction between the parasite and the host, so reciprocity. But co-speciation, on the other hand, does not require the reciprocity. Doesn't need reciprocity. The parasite can just speciate when the host speciates. And it may be the new species may be forming when a host species forms just because it's right going along for the ride, or it gets separated in geographic space along with the host, like humans or pocket gophers or anything.
It does seem like a variety of worms are a particular challenge, maybe for human populations or all kinds of animals, but especially people living in poverty. Why are nematodes of many species so successful as parasites?
Well, nematodes are just so pervasive and so diverse. There are probably more species of nematodes than almost any other thing on the earth as far as an animal goes, except perhaps the mites. But nematodes, parasitic nematodes, are hugely diverse, and they begin infecting free-living organisms as soon as free-living organisms existed. It's pretty an interesting thing. There are geohelminths. Lots of the nematodes are transmitted back and forth to people and among people and other organisms, other animals, by simply fecal contamination of soil, for instance. That's why they're called geohelminths. And then there are others of the nematodes that require intermediate hosts. And that means that the parasite is inside one animal. And to get to the next host, it has to go through an intermediate, something in between. That's why we call it an intermediate. And I'm probably going far from your question, but the nematodes are really diverse. They have direct life cycles. Some of them can simply reproduce inside the host. Others have to go out of the host in order to reproduce. And others must use an intermediate host in order to make it to the next host. So that's really variable. Extremely interesting also.
It seems like a really risky life proposition if you have to find not only multiple hosts of different species, but at the right time. How many parasites actually, what percentage of parasites survive to complete the entire life cycle?
There must be few that make it. Because we know that, for instance, in our book, I talk about the whale tapeworm. And those things put out literally hundreds of millions of eggs per week. The eggs come out into the water column in the ocean from the whale, and then they have to be eaten by a small crustacean in order to make it to the next bigger crustacean, and then it's to make it to the next fish. And then the fish then is eaten by the whale, or it could be direct from crustacean to whale, depending on which whale species we're talking about. But that's one of the hallmarks of parasites, is that they have to literally produce massive quantities of progeny of eggs or larvae or juveniles to make it to the next host. And the probabilities are pretty low that it'll make it. But once they do make it, all bets are off, because the parasites can even change the behavior of the host. And then that behavior then is changed so it can be eaten more easily by the next host. So it's really an amazing and fun thing to study.
So if that Bible story of Jonah who finds himself in the belly of a whale were actually to happen, Jonah might find himself sharing space with a tapeworm that is 30 meters long.
Yes, isn't that cool?
What is it's it called? Cool and terrible.
I know, Tetragonocephalus. It's just a giant tapeworm. Here at the museum, at our state museum, we have a model of one hanging up above the parasitology display. And the students look up and go, oh my God, that thing's huge. So they're big, and people can get 20 meter tapeworms too, big ones. And we have in our book, we have pictures of those kinds of tapeworms coming from a bear, for instance.
Wow. And that photograph that you include in the book is pretty jarring.
The bear one is cool.
Let's warn people that it's gross, but then describe it.
Well, it's not that gross. The reason it's not too gross is because everybody has had parasites at some point in their life. Pinworms, most kids in North America, South America, other temperate regions have pinworms sometime. But in this bear, it's a grizzly or a brown bear. It's a brown bear in Alaska, and it was taken by one of our friends, Scott Davis, and he took a picture of this bear with this tapeworm that was coming out of its posterior end, I should say. And as those segments come out and go into the water, then the eggs come out, and then the eggs are then eaten by these little tiny crustaceans called copepods. And then later a fish eats it, and then it goes on. So it's on the next page, you can see that Scott found a tapeworm that came out of that bear on the ground and picked it up to show people what it looked like. And that's plate number 3 in the book. It's quite interesting.
I always love talking to scientists because I'm imagining your friend Scott finding this in the wild and taking photographs and being really excited about it.
Yes, he's really smiling holding that thing up, isn't he, in that picture?
So, as you mentioned, mites are also kind of superstars of the parasite world. Pretty much every species, this blew my mind, every species of plant and animal is susceptible to some kind of mite infestation.
Yes, mites. We really didn't go into mites too much in the book, but some nematodes utilize mites as their intermediate host. So a nematode inside, for instance, a pocket gopher, which lives in North America, or a tuco, which lives in South America. And I talk about that in the book. If you want to know more about them, you can read in depth. But the mites are the intermediate host there. So they take a blood meal from, or a lymph or blood meal from the host, which has these nematodes in them, and all these little tiny larvae are in the blood or lymph. And then the mite is infected, and then the mite then transfers to the next host and bites it, and the host becomes infected. So it's a really interesting life cycle that has evolved in these types of nematodes. And those are called filarioid nematodes. You can kind of think of the word filarial. It sounds kind of thin and wispy. It kind of looks like a hair. It's very, very a good name, an appropriate name for those kinds of animals.
So these things are just teeny tiny, is that right, mostly?
The larvae, the juveniles of the juvenile nematodes are very, very small, like 25 micrometers, which is just there's 1,000 micrometers in a millimeter. So you can see how small that would be. It's very small. Some of the nematodes, the filariate nematodes that live in humans or in other mammals, the adults are big and they can be in your skin, under your skin, or in the body cavity in various places. But then they produce the microfilaria, and these microfilaria are the juveniles, and they come out in the bloodstream or in the lymph system, and then they're transmitted to the next host by some type of blood-feeding insect or a mite type thing.
Scott, we're often told that viruses really can't live until they find a host, or maybe never live at all, but can't do anything until they find a host. Are viruses parasites by definition?
Well, the classical definition of a parasite is something that's a helminth, worm, or some type of protozoan. Viruses are parasitic, but they're not classically studied by parasitologists. They're mostly studied by virologists, but viruses have the same signature. They have to transmit from host to host, or tissue to tissue, or cell to cell. And so they do have all the things that they need as a parasite, but they're basically inert organisms until they infect a host and then infect a host cell and then take over that host cell. So they are parasitic, but in general, as far as parasitologists go, they're not generally studied as part of the parasitology curriculum. But when I teach parasitology, I do mention viruses quite a lot.
There are some really bizarre kinds of parasitic relationships that aren't quite what we've talked about so far. How does it happen that some birds lay their eggs in the nests of other bird species, leaving the work of caring for those eggs to other animals entirely?
Yeah, like the brown-headed cowbird, for instance. They are what are called nest parasites, and they're opportunistic egg layers. They don't The female and male brown-headed cowbirds don't bother making their own nest. They mate, and then the female looks for the nest of some other bird, and they lay the egg in there and leave. And hopefully, they're hoping that that egg will not be discovered until the baby hatches. And then sometimes most of the time, the baby then is just fed by the parents. So that's I would call it a evolutionary convergence, to put it in the most easy way to say it. A convergent evolution in bird nest parasitism has happened lots of times through the bird tree of life. So if you look at the bird phylogeny, there's all kinds of birds in different groups that are parasitic or that have the parasitic egg laying method.
I've heard of the problem of river blindness in a lot of developing countries, and I know that eliminating that threat has been a major focus for the Carter Center. I didn't know it was linked to a parasitic infection. How does the nematode that causes river blindness find its way to human hosts?
Yes, the river blindness is caused by as I talked about earlier, filarioid nematode and those are called Oncocerca. The nematodes, males and females, there's different sexes of them. They live in the skin of infected people, and they, as the juvenile nematodes are produced and come out in the lymph system, they can then get into the eyes and cause the eyes to become clouded over, and then you go blind. I'm not a medical doctor, so I don't know the exact reasons that all that occurs, but we do know that the life cycle is quite complex. It goes, the nematodes in people are producing these juveniles, and if the cysts of the nematodes that the nematodes live in are near the head region, then the nematode juveniles can cause blindness. And the reason that the juveniles are in the skin in the first place is because that's how they get to their next host. So they're in the skin, the females are producing juveniles into the skin, and black flies come along and feed on the blood of the infected individual, an infected person. And then the juvenile nematodes go into the black fly, go through a couple of molts, and then go into the salivary system of the black fly. And then the black fly flies to a new host and bites that person and infects the person. So it's a really interesting and complex life cycle. And the way that this is being combated is that people are being given different kinds of drugs that kill the juvenile nematodes in the skin. And so that's one way to do it. Another way they're combating this is to use insecticides to kill the black flies. So, but black flies grow in quickly flowing water, fast flowing streams. And the larval black flies live in very quick, fast flowing water. And so it looks like a beautiful stream, but it might have a lot of black flies in it. If you've ever been camping up in the North Woods, you've probably been, in the summer, you've been attacked by black flies. They're not very pleasant. So the way scientists are combating the river blindness is by giving people ivermectin, and the ivermectin then is effective at eliminating the juvenile nematodes from the bloodstream.
So people may know the name ivermectin because that was suggested as a COVID-19 treatment. It does not work for that, but it does work to combat river blindness.
Yes, and it was developed by one of our friends, Bill Campbell at Merck. I think it was Pfizer. But anyway, he developed this in conjunction with a professor from Japan, and they came up with this avermectin, and then they changed it into a related compound called ivermectin, and that's what they use now for, well, if you have a dog, you give it Felerabits to keep your dog from getting heartworm, for instance. And so that's another use of this ivermectin drug.
Why does it happen that immune systems don't often pick up on the presence of parasites and drive them out of the bodies of an infected animal?
Well, there's been a lot of research done on that. And the answer is manifold. There are many, many answers to that question. Some parasites hide from the immune system in plain sight. And what I mean by that is they can be in the blood. There's trematodes, flatworms called schistosomes that live in the blood of people and all kinds of other birds and mammals, but the ones that are in humans live there. And the trematodes can snag different kinds of proteins from the blood and coat themselves with it. So our body's immune system cannot recognize the trematode because it's coated with our own immune system cells, material. So it says, looks like that's just a normal human cell type, so I'm not going to attack it. So our immune system is basically fooled by the parasite, which covers itself up with these different parts of proteins from the blood system. It's a really good way to do it.
I was going to say, I don't like thinking about it, but it's a really good trick.
It is. There's another way, too. There's a trypanosome, a protistin or protozoan parasite, that's transmitted by kissing bugs. The kissing bug transmits it to humans by defecating on the skin of the human, and the person can, you could rub some of the feces that has the infective protistins in the feces into your mucous membranes on your mouth or into your eye or into the wound that the kissing bug had made in your skin. And then the trypanosomes penetrate into your blood system, and the way they hide is they go into intercellular spaces. So they actually go inside the cell, and they're hiding from the immune system by staying inside cells. And so that's a really tough one because there's basically, once you're infected with Chagas disease, there's no cure for it now. They are working really hard on trying to figure out a cure for it. I think in the last 2 years, there's been some drugs that have been discovered that you can treat younger people within like 2 weeks of infection, and that will clear the infection. But right now, if you're infected is over for a longer period of time with a chronic infection, you've got it and there's no way to get rid of it.
Could learning more about the mechanisms by which parasites evade the immune system have implications for people trying to help organ transplant recipients not reject the new organ?
Oh, yes. That's one of the big problems with parasites. And that's going off into an area that I have not too much expertise in as far as immune modulation, but many parasites can modulate the immune system, the immune response of the host. And sometimes when someone gets an organ transplant, if the organ was not checked really carefully before they do the transplant, a person who's receiving the transplant could actually get the parasite. So one of those is trypanosomes. And the other one is something called toxoplasma. And there are others too. There are nematodes that can can do the same thing, that really, if your immune system goes down, the nematodes can basically take over. So there's a really huge area of research going on, and there's a lot of opportunity for students and people to do work in this area.
I want to talk about Toxoplasma gondii, because this is one of those parasites that can have different effects depending on which organisms it invades as hosts, right?
Yes. Toxoplasma basically is a cat parasite. It's a protozoan parasite that has an impermeable and impervious shell, I guess you could call it, on its what's called an oocyst, which is like an egg for a metazoan animal, something that's complex with lots of cells. But these protistans have just a few cells, or one. Why don't we start with the life cycle? I would say that all cats are infected with this parasite. It's called Toxoplasma, and the cats act as the definitive host. So that means that's where sexual recombination of the parasite occurs in the cat itself. The cat's intestinal villi, the little finger-like projections that are inside the small intestine, are infected, and these oocysts mature and then pass out in the feces of the cat, and then it takes about 14 days, and then the oocysts are then infective. And if someone actually eats some feces from a cat after it's been sitting there for 14 days, then you can be infected. And of course, you know that if you have a cat in a house, it is very difficult to not have a little bit of feces around, just because it's a cat and they spread things around. You know, you get into a litter box, you scrape around, then you walk around, there's some feces that's going to be moving around. So in a domestic situation where a cat is living, the cat ate a mouse, the mouse infected the cat then produced oocysts, and then people can become infected. So it's a really common parasite, is maybe one of the most common parasites in North America in people. And as you might know, people who are infected with the AIDS virus, when the immune system first starts to go down, the toxoplasma that's in people, most people are infected, probably 90% of the human population has got antibodies to the toxoplasma parasite, and that means that they're infected with it. And if the immune system crashes, then toxoplasma takes off and will kill you. So humans are dead-end hosts for that, because we don't have lions around eating us, but that's the reason. But basically, it's a cat, rodent, or cat, bird life cycle. People become infected when they eat undercooked meat, or they can be infected when they eat undercooked poultry, or they can be infected when they clean a cat litter box or pet their cat or whatever. But the way to keep from getting this is to clean your cat box every couple of days and don't let it sit around.
Scott, how common is it for parasites to evolve ways to modify the behavior of their host?
Extremely common. That was one of the things that that we wrote about in our book, and it's also one of the points that has been made by a lot of different authors over time. Some parasites can change their host by advertising that, hey, I've got a parasite. There are some snails, when they get a trematode parasite, which is a flatworm, some of the trematodes move up into the antenna of the snail and start to pulsate, making the antenna pulsate, and a bird sees that, says, hey, I'm going to eat that snail, and then the snail gets eaten, and then the parasite is transferred. So that's an example of a visual cue that changes the parasite, or changes the host, that causes the host to be eaten. And there's been a lot of press lately about toxoplasma in people. If you're infected with toxoplasma, then you have different behavioral, it might modify your behavior in some way. And we've probably read about the studies where if a mouse is infected with toxoplasma, which is that protozoan protistan parasite again, the mouse then is less averse to cat urine, for instance. So the mouse might be more easily eaten by a cat. So those are a couple. There are lots of other behavioral changes that parasites can cause their hosts to undergo. One of my friends, Janice Moore at Colorado State University, worked on the changes that acanthocephalin parasites, these are thorny-headed worms that live in birds. She looked at birds, and she looked at the number of parasites in bird nests, and she found that the number of parasites in baby birds was much higher than you would expect if you were just looking at these kinds of parasites, acanthocephalin parasites, was much higher than you would expect. And so she did a study where she actually looked at roly-polies, and she looked at roly-polies, and she studied the number of roly-polies going into mouths of baby birds, and she found that the parasites were more common than you would expect if they were just feeding roly-polies randomly to the babies. These are adult birds feeding these things to their babies. So she found that the parasite changes the behavior of these roly-polies once they become infected. So instead of them going into darker areas, they come out into lighter areas, and they're more easily preyed upon by the adult bird, which then takes it to the baby. So that was one of the very first good examples of parasites changing the behavior of the host. And she's emeritus now from Colorado State.
What is a curator of parasites exactly? Do you have a lot of organisms preserved in some kind of chemical, or what is your collection like at the laboratory?
Yeah, that's really cool. Thanks for asking about it. We have the second most extensive parasite collection in the Western Hemisphere. The Smithsonian has the largest. But we have some of the areas that we have are even deeper. We have specimens on microscope slides that are preserved in what's called Canada balsam or gum damar. And they're stained and they're on slides, and then people can borrow the slides, or they can ask us to put the slide on a microscope, and then we transmit the images of the specimens to the people who are interested in this. Or we have specimens in our freezers. We have ultra cold freezers, minus 85 degrees centigrade freezers, that have a lot of the parasites in them that we preserved and we collected from our work in Bolivia, Mexico, Mongolia, North America, Colombia, other places. So we have a lot of material in freezers that people can use for various purposes, like looking at DNA sequencing of the different parasites to see how they're related and maybe where they came from. We also have hundreds of thousands of vials of parasites that people have collected. Most of the material that we have in the collection was not collected by me. It was collected by thousands and thousands of other people who are documenting global parasite biological diversity. So what the scientists are doing is basically documenting life on Earth at certain snapshots in time, over space, and through different ecological regions. So it's a really deep collection that we have here, and extremely important to understand what's here now and what might be expected in the future and what we have in the past. So it's a really deep and diverse collection that represents, really, as I said, global parasite biological diversity. It's really cool.
Because even as we're trying to understand how organisms and ecosystems are changing on this planet, we're not done documenting the biodiversity that exists here, right?
No, we are not. We're probably one-tenth, maybe 1/100th of the way. Most free living organisms, as we said at the beginning, have mites or nematodes. Most mammals have ticks and mites on them, and fleas and nematodes and tapeworms, trematodes, acanthocephalins. And we really don't know a lot about the wild animals out there. For instance, our work in Bolivia has been ongoing since I started working there in 1984. And we just published a, another, where we're just publishing another paper in the Journal of Mammalogy, where we talk about the diversity of just the tucos in South America. And if you then add on that each of these tucos probably has two or three species of parasites that are host specific to them, that's a lot of parasites, because there's 65 or more species of tuco. So it's really, and that's something I know a lot about. 61 species of pocket govers in North America. They all have different kinds of parasites also. So it's, most of them have never been looked at. We are just working as hard as we can to understand the diversity of these things before it's gone, because once it's gone, it's not coming back. Once, what I mean by gone is extinct by land use changes or deforestation or whatever. So we're really working hard at trying to understand global diversity before it's gone. And if we do that, then we can then make predictions about what might be happening in the future. And other people can use those data to make predictions also, not just us.
I'm not sure I had ever heard of tucos until I picked up your book. I was really glad that you included a photograph. These guys are cute. What do they look like?
Isn't that a beautiful picture, that big old tuco? We call them buck-toothed potatoes. Basically, they're fusiform. They imagine a big potato, and it's got two front feet, two back feet, a tail, and big chewing teeth, and they're able to go down a hole and turn around. They have loose skin. They have really thick and thick fur, and they're able to burrow through their burrowing systems and kick dirt out. So it's really an amazing, amazing adaptation. And there's subterranean rodents on all the continents except Antarctica. And we have the tucos are extremely diverse in South America. In Bolivia, there's a bunch of species. We described four new species just a few years ago. And the reason we did the tucos first, because they all have parasites, but you can't, I couldn't justifiably say, well, I got this new parasite from an undescribed species of tuco. So we had to go ahead and describe them first. So that was quite a task in itself.
So it's easy for people, I think, to think about parasites as kind of the bad guys in the animal kingdom, given their dependence on other animals. But tell us about parasites that might contribute to beneficial outcomes within ecosystems.
Well, a lot of work has been done on parasites that live in marine and brackish water ecosystems, especially by people in California. Kevin Laverty and Armin Kiras have been doing a lot of that work. And they found that the amount of parasite biomass in these ecosystems is extreme. It's really huge. It's like there's the snail. All the snails are infected with these things, and all of them have thousands of these larvae, juvenile trematodes that live in them. And of course, if they're eaten by something, they contribute to the energetics of the system, of the ecological system. They also, if they're eaten by a bird, then the bird becomes infected if it's the right host. So they're really, it's a very complex operation. It's stunning to really see how many parasites are in an ecosystem. Some parasites there are some kinds of parasites that are called entomopathogenic parasites, and they can be used as we have. If you've seen some of the advertisements in some of the gardening magazines, you can buy nematodes now and spray them on your tomatoes, and it'll kill the different kinds of insects that might be eating your tomatoes or other garden produce. And those are entomopathogenic nematodes. As far as ecosystem diversity, the parasite links, one of the things that I found is that the links of the parasites are just there. And if you find the different parasites in an ecosystem, like a tapeworm, for instance, if you find it in a small marsupial in South America, then automatically you know that marsupial that's infected with the tapeworm has to have an intermediate host in order to be transmitted to the next marsupial. So just finding the tapeworm automatically gives you information on not only the relationship of the marsupial to its tapeworm, but also you know that there's a complex life cycle happening there. And then if you do that kind of work over space and you find tapeworms only occur in certain areas, then you know that that life cycle is occurring just in that one area and not in others. So that's why it's important. Part of one of the reasons it's important to collect parasites through space and time and record what you find, because if you don't do that, then we would never know that parasites occur in one area but not another. And it's probably because the presence or absence of the intermediate host in that area. So if you kind of catch what I'm saying, it's quite important to have all the data before you can start saying something in general.
Scott, why are isolated islands such a good place to study parasites?
Well, we've been working in the Galapagos a little bit on these tapeworms from Galapagos rice rats. These mice called Oryzomys, Nezoryzomys is the genus. They made it over to the Galapagos maybe 5 million years ago, and they've been kind of moving around over there as the islands form and then develop via volcanism. Well, the reason that we think it's an interesting thing on islands is because if you look at diversity on islands, and this gets into island biogeography, we probably don't have time to go into that in great detail, but the cool thing about this is that we found these tapeworms in these rice rats out there. And what we're doing now is we're almost finished with our paper. We're going to submit this thing probably in the next couple months. And we're trying to understand where the tapeworms came from in the rice rats, because the mice had to have gotten there, the rice rats, and then there had to be an intermediate host there. Otherwise, the life cycle could not continue to occur, so that the tapeworms would have gone extinct. The mouse might have got there, but the intermediate host might not have been there. But it's there, and so the cycle is ongoing, which is, I think, is an interesting, very interesting and exciting aspect. So once you find the tapeworm, you know that there's an intermediate host of some sort there. It's probably an ant, because other people have worked on this kind of tapeworm that we're describing now from this Nezoryzomys, which is the Galapagos mouse. And it's related species. We use what's called the comparative method, and we look at others that might have an intermediate host, and those are turn out to be ants. So the ants are probably acting as intermediate hosts. So there were probably already ants on the islands when the mice got there with their tapeworms, and so they had an automatic intermediate host, so the cycle started going. There are lots of examples of parasitism in animals on islands. For instance, in the Hawaiian Islands, there's a bat called the Hawaiian hoary bat, I think is the name. And it also has a tapeworm, which was described by my uncle, Bob Rausch, in the 1970s. And it's interesting that these bats were probably blown into the Hawaiian Islands from North America. But in order for them to have a tapeworm that was cycling, there had to be an intermediate host there. So 99.9% of all tapeworms have to use an intermediate host to make it to their next host, to make it to their next mammalian host. So that's an interesting one too. These questions you're asking are extremely deep and complex, and we could go on for a long time for each one.
Well, I do want to ask you this. You note in the book that parasites probably have a vastly greater effect on human existence than birds do, but there are 6 times as many trained ornithologists working in the U.S. as parasitologists. If folks do not, as I guess you do, have a parasitologist uncle to lead them to the business, what do you think could draw more people into such an important field of study?
Well, Chris, this is a good question. And that's part of the reason we wrote this book, is because we think that Judy and Gabor and I think that this kind of a book might have an influence on people to get them interested in these types of processes, these types of host-parasite relationships. I like the idea of species discovery, finding what kinds of species are out there and describing them, getting them understood, and then working with them to understand their role in nature. And so this book is kind of designed for that. So that's an idea. And so when I teach my parasitology courses, I have the same level of enthusiasm that I have right now. We go into those courses, and by the time the students leave my course, my field courses or my lecture courses at the university here, it's kind of a transformative experience. And I've had students who have gone on and gotten their PhDs because they took my class.
Any role for citizen scientists in this work?
There is. The citizen science is a burgeoning area of scientific collaboration between people who do hardcore work on things like I do and people who are interested in this, in the diversity and basically diversity and ecological relationships of different kinds of parasites through space. The problem with that is that you have to have some really pretty specific training in order to understand how to collect these things in a way that is both ethical and is appropriate for the kinds of different kinds of parasites that you're collecting. You can't use the same method of collecting for all parasites. And you also, as we know more though, as we're understanding more and more about diversity, we're finding that we can understand a lot by simply looking at a fecal pellet of a single animal from a field, and then we can do DNA sequencing, and then we can understand the species that are in those animals without even touching the animal itself. And I think that's a really a place that citizen science could come in if they take accurate measurements of where they're collecting these types of materials, save it carefully, and then are able to get it to someone who can do DNA sequencing. And of course, sequencing is getting cheaper and cheaper, then we can get species names. The problem with that is that we don't have DNA sequences on very many parasites from wild animals. And that is where the big problem is. We just don't have enough to say with certainty that the species, it's either species A or species B. It could be a whole range of species. We know that if we have DNA sequence, we can say, okay, it's one of these, but we don't know which yet. That leads us to then go in and try to find out which species it might be and ask more questions.
Scott L. Gardner is curator of parasites in the H.W. Manter Laboratory of Parasitology at the University of Nebraska. His book, written with Judy Diamond and Gabor Rox, is called Parasites, The Inside Story. Scott, thanks for spending this time with us.
Oh, you're so welcome, Chris. This has really been fun. As you can tell, I'm quite excited about talking about parasitism and parasites. And I wish you well for the new year.
You as well. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching for KERA Think. And you can get the podcast anywhere you get podcasts. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.